The views and opinions expressed in the following program do not necessarily reflect those of WPRK, its management, or employees of Rollins College.
Don't push me, cause I'm close to the edge. I'm trying not to lose my head. It's like a jungle sometimes. It makes me wonder how I keep from going under. All programs.
All right, welcome to Punkonomics, your weekly issues show. And we talk about just about everything underneath the sun, and then a little bit more, usually irritating those in government and business alike. My name is Jesse Velez, I am the co-host, and sitting next to me is Dr. Benjamin Balick. And today, we have a special guest. His name is Nicholas Davies. We like to call him Sandy. All right. Punkonomics.
Hello, hello, hello. Yeah, well, actually, I'm like trying to send a nice authored blog post, but I'm not sure I'm getting to the interwebs. As down in the cellar here, we have a hard time, and I think maybe one of the routers busted. No, I'm getting decent Wi-Fi. I don't know what's going on. But anyway, so the people on the air will be maybe the only ones who know about it, and the others will find out later when I'm up on the surface of the planet again, where I can get my expensive, relatively slow 4G. But enough of my whining. There's much worse going on, and Sandy will help us with that. That's for
I'm sure.
So I wanted to point out that we have had him before on the show. I mean, I'll welcome him in a minute. I mean, I don't know. Shall I do some blah blahing where you call him?
Yeah,
that's the plan.
Yeah, let everybody know what it's about. And
right, I'll do that, and then we'll get him on the air as soon as possible, hopefully, so that we can ask him questions and hear what he has to say. Because we've had him on the show twice before already, and what's professional, what's amateur in journalism today? Amateur with a capital A, I'd like to call it, in the sense that, like us, he has to pay the bills by other means because he doesn't write, he doesn't work for mainstream media, but he posts a lot of excellent articles over many years to alternative media sources, ZMag, Alternet, to just name the two most recent ones. And whenever something brews in the foreign policy, a war front, and sadly, of course, that's quite often, he writes it up. It's almost it's almost uncanny in the sense that whenever I'm kind of, man, this is so confusing. People are asking questions. What the bleep is going on? There comes Sandy writing an article that clarifies it with brutal honesty and researched facts. And pierces through the Mickey Mouse versions that we are so familiar with, especially when it comes to foreign policy, quite frankly. So he wrote a couple over the years since, I met him here working at Rollins College, he doesn't work here, but I met him here, and he kind of ever since been reading his stuff. And he's informed us about the wars, several wars in the past, and now it's all about ISIS, isn't it? So I think they've made the connection, and I've made some brief introductions, and I'm yelling myself in the ear, so I'll just trust Jesse to know what's going on in terms of the audio.
Yeah, everybody.
Yeah, I don't know. My headphones, I can't do the headphones thing. It's like I speak to myself in my own head, and I feel like, schizophrenic a little bit. It's weird.
Okay, so we got Sandy on the line.
Right. And so I post. I don't know if it managed to post. There's a lot of complaining icons flashing from my phone, but I will try. Actually, I was counting on being able to look at that. But anyway, as I was saying before Sandy got on the line, so he knows that I'm not just out of the blue. So I told him a little bit about you. Reminded them that they can go dig through punkonomics.org, by the way, to find both previous 1 hour podcast interviews as well as links to previous articles on other foreign affairs and issues of international law and general war. Cheery topic there. And quite recently, we could start with this fascinating article on Alternet and several others. I'm sure you'll just start like last time let you tell us about it, and I'm sure the conversation will flow darkly thereafter. Yeah. So the most recent one on alternet.org is why Showdown Islamic. I'm looking at the link and having some internet difficulties here, but I do want to read it out loud, not the entire article. Why the showdown with Islamic extremists is the war the Pentagon was hoping for. This guy is not a conspiracy theorist. He researches his work. Hi, Sandy.
Yes, hi, Benny. Yeah, I don't know how many of your listeners have had a chance to read the article, but...
Probably not, of a very small minority, yeah. So yeah. Tell us a little bit about it.
Well, I mean, basically, what I tried to cover in the article is... I compare what is happening now with 1990, 1991, when, in a sense, this all began in terms of the U.S. attacking Iraq. And I think our leaders in Washington look back on that first Gulf War as a successful operation. They got a lot of other countries involved, and, George Bush said afterwards that, you know, by God, we've kicked the Vietnam syndrome once and for all. And it also had a fantastic effect. There we were at the end of the Cold War. Former senior U.S. officials were talking about cutting the U.S. military budget in half, what they called the peace dividend. And instead... as a result, very much, of the first Gulf War, they saved the Cold War military-industrial complex. Since 1991, the U.S. military budget has never fallen below its Cold War baseline of an inflation-adjusted $390 billion a year. And right now, it's still at over $600 billion dollars a year, which is higher than at any time during the Vietnam War or at the height of Ronald Reagan's one-sided arms race in the 1980s. So, and U.S. arms exports, partly as a result of Bush's coalition building, it was a huge boost for U.S. arms exports, which hit all-time highs in the 2 years following that war. And what seems to be happening today is really a repeat performance in all those respects, that this will kill any prospect of actually cutting the U.S. military budget and diverting badly needed funds to the real needs of the American people. And also, it will presumably also boost arms sales to all our so-called coalition partners, you know, who of course, whose militaries are now cheek and jowl with the U.S. military, but not afforded the generous funding that the American people provide for our military forces to be, you know, to have the newest, best equipment of all their colleagues around the world. So, you know, basically, they will once again, unless we're able to mount a successful counter-narrative, this will once again save the U.S. military-industrial complex.
Yeah, well, I'm hoping to, just to give things frame also, I'm hoping to a little bit later also ask you beyond that to just kind of, you know, use your expertise to ask you a little bit to tell us a question I've been asked often, and sometimes it's a difficult question, so we'll try and do it to explain a little bit what's going on recently. So one of the things you just said now, just to underline, if you will, it's interesting how the initial the gas attacks in Syria, was it a year and a half ago now? There was the drums of war were beating. We were getting ready to go there and do something about it, but the American people, in some sense, with famous filibuster by the libertarian Rand Paul and all that, and basically not much support, certainly popular, put a stop to it. And it, I mean, the cynic in me says that, well, they kind of worked it around a little bit to find a way to get us to swallow this after all. This time. So it took him a while to re-engineer the story so that now, we do have a relatively broad consensus and very few dissenting voices in positions of power, in either party.
Yeah, it's quite extraordinary, really, because, at that time, just about a year ago, you know, members of Congress were overwhelmed with phone calls and emails and letters, opposing an attack on Syria, because I think that was viewed very differently. I think the American public saw that as the U.S. getting involved in a new war, essentially trying to overthrow another Middle Eastern government, very much along the lines of what we had done to Iraq, and so. You know, I mean, there were Republican members of Congress in Florida telling the press that they had received something like 1,000 calls and emails, and that, you know, they were 99% even opposing military action. And as you say, our government has done a very expert job of turning things, or turning the narrative around, and so, you know, rather than while there are actually rumors of a secret deal with the Saudis to essentially say support us going after ISIS, and then we promise you that once we've dealt with ISIS, we will actually overthrow the government of Syria.
Yeah.
So in other words, there may be a behind the scenes deal here to actually accomplish the same goal that they were essentially trying to achieve a year ago.
Right, because we will surely get back there, but yeah, the Syria
conflict.
This has
been framed in a very different way. Now it's been framed as part of the war on terror. Now we're not attacking the Syrian government. Now we are attacking this terrible, shadowy terrorist group.
In a weird way, we're kind of with the Syrian government.
Beheaded American hostages, a British hostage, and, so it's cast the whole thing in a different light, and the American public seem to be seeing it quite differently because of that.
You think, that's an interesting way of seeing it. I mean, a cynic could say that when we have these people, it wasn't enough to see a clearly not a very savory fellow, Assad, in Syria. Whether both sides were involved, and it's complicated, and hopefully we will have a time to clarify a little bit of that. But gassing his own people, a kind of a tart phrase at this point. But yeah, he probably did, and then others did too.
Well,
and
there's
who
a lot
doesn't?
Of questions
yes,
about that actually.
Right, I know. Yeah, right. I mean, maybe he did, maybe he didn't. Probably, if he did, then both sides did.
Well, actually, Benny, I would say the prime suspects, and it's really not clear, are Qatari special forces who have been embedded with the al-Nusra Front since the very beginning. And those Qatari special forces, by the way, are mostly not Qataris. These are the same guys who were in Libya, who led the assault on Gaddafi's headquarters in Tripoli. And like the rest of Qatar's armed forces, these are mostly essentially mercenaries, and the largest proportion of them come from Pakistan. And so the ones who are the Qatari special forces, to a great extent, are led by, as I understand it, by veterans of Pakistan's intelligence agency, the ISI, and the Pakistani border forces, who essentially work with the Taliban in the border areas of Pakistan, Afghanistan, and Kashmir. And so, you know, it's certainly not inconceivable by any stretch that that they somehow introduced chemical weapons into Syria and taught the al-Nusra Front how to use them, and that it, in fact the so-called attack may have in fact been essentially a botched operation with people who were not properly trained to use such weapons. The other suspect, the other very strong suspect in chemical weapons use in Syria is in fact, of course, Turkey. Mm. Now, I was told by Larry Johnson, former CIA counterterrorism expert, that the prime state sponsors of terrorism in the world today are in fact Pakistan, Saudi Arabia, and Turkey. And Turkey, you know, are really deeply involved in all of the violence taking place in Syria and in, you know, essentially providing a safe haven since 2011, where fighters for all the different rebel groups, including ISIS in Syria, you know, they basically have an open border with Turkey. They're able to go back and forth. They're able to bring arms across that border. They're able to go back across the border into Turkey and receive medical treatment. And there are training camps for the Free Syrian Army and different Syrian groups in Turkey as well as in Jordan. And so, in fact, Turkey is playing a very similar role in this entire crisis that Pakistan played in the civil war in Afghanistan in the 1980s, also with CIA and Saudi support. And so really, you know, we are, you know, I think most Americans now understand that the U.S. and Saudi role in the civil war in Afghanistan in the 1980s led directly to September the 11th. And yet we are now engaged in a very, very similar situation in Syria and Iraq, empowering forces very similar to the Mujahideen in Pakistan and Afghanistan that eventually formed Al-Qaeda. Except if there's a difference, it's that this has even more quickly devolved into, you know, incredibly dangerous, multifaceted, jihadi formation of almost exploding, you know, one group into another, more and more violent extremist jihadi groups in Syria. So,
and beyond, you know, right? And beyond, and in
so,
Africa.
So then, I mean, we come to the questions of the U.S. response and what might be a better response to that, which we can go on and talk about at some point.
Yeah, we should definitely make a point of whatever we go, we at the end kind of try and articulate some kind of a other way of doing or what not to do or what possibly to do. But first, the bloodshed is terrible. I mean, you're making these comparisons, and there are a couple of things that I want to hear from you about. Clearly, it's important to note, and let's make a shameless plug, right? I was joking with my students about that. I think the Pope must be reading our blog or listening to the show. I'm kind of joking. I don't think he really is. But he made a speech of something that I like to think of and say out loud often, is that despite not having a World War III going on in the traditional sense, the bloodshed all over the world is probably equal in the sense of how many people die per week, and innocent civilians and destruction, if you count the fact that what you were just describing is happening in Africa, it's happening, my God, maybe we even go there. It's somewhat happening in Europe even. There's a little bit of experimental in Ukraine. But you started by talking about the fact, when you hear all this, it's like a conspiracy theory, right? A conspiracy theory within a conspiracy theory. The rabbit hole seems to go, no matter how deep you go, there's further depth to explore. So the question immediately arises, why? Why are we doing it? Of course, you kind of answered from one point of view at least, and I would like to really see maybe the players here. We have those Gulf states that you mentioned. We have Turkey. Why are they involved in this way? Of course, I'm sure you'll introduce to us some of the dynamics of with Iran, of course, is a common enemy here for the Gulf states. And America, then, we're looking at the Pentagon. I mean, are they rogue here? I mean, I'm not trying to ask a facetious question. In some sense, I think this same question has been asked. You're tracing it from the 80s, from the end of the Soviet Union, and instead of putting our money, you know, what's the biblical expression, right? Turning our swords into plows and investing in our infrastructure, education, good life. We maintained, as your article details, the military position. A similar question may have happened after World War II also. I think under the Truman administration was a little bit about that, wasn't it? So this whole notion of the military-industrial complex in action.
Absolutely. Yeah, I mean, you can trace it back to, I mean, in the previous article, I sort of traced it back to September the 11th, mm-hmm. because my previous article came out on September the 11th, the 13th anniversary.
I'll link all those articles, by the way, on the blog post sometime early next week, etc. Yes.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I think, you know, But going back to the end of the Cold War and the fall of the Soviet Union, I mean, you know, up until then, this industrial complex, which had not existed before World War II, you know, it was justified and perpetuated based on, you know, confronting the Soviet Union in the Cold War. And, of course, you know, I would highly recommend people reading books that question that whole narrative, and I mean, one of my favorites is by D.F. Fleming. He wrote it in the early 60s, and that is simply titled The Cold War and Its Origins. You know, it's a big two-volume history.
Incidentally, really for somebody who's a little bit lazy or doesn't have the time, one could find, I think, a reinterpretation of that story rather well done in Oliver Stone's Hidden History of the United States, in the first chapters of that, where he actually, it's not like Stalin, we had to do something about Stalin again. We should be by now a little bit familiar with this whole, like, people who pop out and, oh my God, we have to do something about them. Are we egging them on? Are we actually, yeah.
Right. And you know, in a sense, I mean, there were always, you know, the so-called revisionists, historians who said, no, you know, it's not the Soviet Union that's the evil empire. They're just a pretext for, you know, the U.S. trying to dominate the whole world. And unfortunately, now I think we can look back, you know, 25 years to the fall of the Berlin Wall and the end of the Soviet Union and see how the U.S. has, in fact, responded to not having a so-called evil empire out there to confront. And in fact, you know, while most Americans at the end of the whole Cold War were looking for the peace dividend, there really was this whole other strain amongst U.S. officials in Washington who actually saw the end of the Cold War as an opportunity for a power dividend. In fact, without, you know, the Soviet Union to check our ambitions, the U.S. could actually become more powerful and extend its military operations into areas where it had not been able to go before. And in my article, I quote a guy called Michael Mandelbaum, who worked at the Lexington Institute and was a Pentagon advisor in 1990. And he said, you know, talking about the prospect of war to you know, to attack Iraq and get the Iraqis out of Kuwait, he said, you know, this is finally, this is the first time in 40 years that we can conduct military operations in the Middle East without starting World War III.
No detente.
And, of course, in fact, you know, going back to what you said earlier, you know, in fact, maybe he was wrong. And, in fact, in a sense, by doing that, we did start World War III. At least, I think, if you were somebody who lived in Iraq or Syria or Libya or several other places, Afghanistan, you know, I think the notion that this is, you know, you might really question the notion that this is not, in fact, World War III.
Yeah. The vast majority of the world, it's been actually studies recently, right? A vast majority of the world, not surprisingly, considered the United States to be by far the prime source of threat and instability. So the United States is feared almost universally around the planet. But then here's a kind of the political economic question in some sense. So yeah, so isn't it good? I mean, right? It's great to be. It's just like being a Roman citizen. We're ruling the world with a arm, you know.
Right, and there's actually, I mean, there's really a parallel. You know, I'm from England originally, and I mean, in a sense, this is a bit like the British Empire in the 19th century. You know, I had an ancestor, a great-great-grandfather, who rose up through the ranks of the military, retired as a major or a colonel or something. But, you know, I was able to track his regiment through the early part of the 19th century. You know, he was at the Battle of Waterloo against Napoleon.
Yeah.
And after that, you know, he was in India, he was in Canada, he was in the Caribbean, you know, all over the world. And he was, you know, again, this is the similarity, I think, with today for young people who join up to the U.S. military. Whereas during the Cold War, I mean, my father was in the British Navy throughout the 1950s and 60s, mm-hmm. and he was on a ship that shelled Korea during the Korean War. But for nearly, I mean, the entire rest of his career, he was essentially serving in a peacetime military, a American trench in the Caribbean, and, you know, fighting rebellious tribe people in India. And so in a sense, this is now the U.S. military is now serving as a sort of, you know, colonial or imperial military, you know, being dispatched off to different places around the world to put down rebellions by rebellious tribespeople, which is essentially what is happening in Iraq. And now there's really a very disturbing history to the history of colonial forces bombing in Iraq, because the whole use of bombing as a form of imperial policing, you know, was developed in Iraq in the 1920s by the British.
Right, first time a gassing civilian
population.
They
were not just bombing, but they were firebombing. Mm-hmm. This became a technique for the British once they took over Iraq in 1919. You know, whenever some tribe somewhere in Iraq's a pretty big area, and they, you know, the British didn't have a lot of military forces there. It was after World War One; they were trying to have a small footprint of boots on the ground, as the Americans are today. So they developed firebombing as a form of policing. If some tribe somewhere in Iraq refused to pay its taxes to the king, the British installed king in Baghdad, the British sent a squadron of biplanes with firebombs. This is sort of the earliest form of napalm, and they simply flew over the village and burned the place to the ground. And And funnily enough, also another disturbing historical anomaly is that the leader of one of those squadrons was a guy named Arthur Harris, who later became the head of RAF Bomber Command in World War II. And essentially, after this technique had been used in Iraq and in Afghanistan and in Palestine, he then used the same technique on a much larger scale in Germany to burn to the ground the medieval city of Dresden and my sister-in-law's home in Cologne. The fact that we are, you know, using bombing as a form of imperial policing, essentially, in Iraq, where this was first developed in the 1920s by the British, and the British are now once again bombing in Iraq, too, you know, this really should give us all good reason to really think seriously about whether, you know, not only whether this is a horrific form of imperial policing, but also just the fact that we are still doing this almost a century later, where it was first begun 90 years ago. And the fact that there's still, from the imperial point of view, seems to be a need for this after 90 years of it, really should lead us to question, if this can possibly be effective in any way at all.
No, it's a deep political economic question, really. If you the model of empire, to some extent, history teaches us that it doesn't it implodes eventually. It's a relatively short-lived, or sometimes longer than others. But in some sense, perhaps the British Empire was the British people had the advantage of forcefully being de-imperialized by losing their power in World War II, by exhausting themselves in a sense. So that now, with all its problems, it's a functioning country. Though you point out well that they're joining this kind of coalition, but I don't see. I always thought that personally, and maybe I'm wrong, that the model, even with the most sophisticated means, the imperial model is unwise in the long run. Even putting aside the ethical aspect to it, and I'm not putting it aside just for a moment, putting it aside. Just the bloodshed and the horror of what you are forced, if you will, to do if you are going to police the world. The blood of millions is on your hands. There's just not avoiding it with the best intentions. But it just doesn't work too. And it causes tremendous damage. And to go back, I mean, yeah, America rules the world since the Soviets have declined, but it doesn't seem to be working out so well for the vast majority of Americans. Except for the people who hold portfolios in the security and military industrial complex sectors, as your article shows, where the profits are absolutely marvelous. For most Americans, there's no dividend here.
Right. But for the American people, I mean, even compared to, you know, if we compare it to other developed countries that have a slightly different model, that are happy to sort of send a few planes to join the American coalition, but whose economies are not sort of deeply immersed in militarism as ours is, you know, their median standards of living have kept rising when the U.S. median standard of living has really stalled out, and more and
declined,
more people in the U.S. are actually living, you know, below the poverty line. We keep hearing about Europe and all its problems, but, you know, between 2000 and 2010, when the U.S. median income was essentially flat, the country in Europe that had the lowest increase in its median standard of living was the UK,
which of course
is the most like the US, and they nonetheless had a rise in median income of 20% during that same period.
Right, that's important. Yeah, that's a very important thing to remind people too, because again, sometimes I forget. You know, this is not people don't necessarily listen to every week, and then. We have to realize that this is part of a long-term decline. Based somewhere in the 70s, America's economy started to falter in different ways. And while Europe definitely has its problems today, one could say that the countries that are doing better, and again, not by some kind of touchy-feely socialistic measure of a community, but by the most hard-nosed capitalistic measures of growth and innovation and employment and wages and profits even. It's the countries that are relatively more moderate that are doing well. And indeed, England is very much like the United States and failing in similar ways. Not that they don't have their problems, but I think many of their problems, in fact, are probably, I would think, due to the fact that they are rather eagerly copying the United States. For reasons perhaps that they want part of the pie. They want to be junior members in this operation too. Their elites, the minority that benefits from these kind of policies, the very tiny minority, is also powerful there. Maybe not able to get away with murder like here, but working hard to get there.
You know, it's good that they're not copying them with the healthcare.
This is, by the way, Shaheen, who I was going to jump in.
That's right. It's Shaheen from the now defunct international scene here, yeah. WPRK. We're going to bring that back soon.
And in the risk of being inappropriate, I'm gonna say it. I mean, you know, he knows I love him. It's okay. I mean, he's Saudi, so he's like, he's in there, right? Okay, but he's scribbling interesting questions on the paper, and I was actually intending to have him actually launch us there himself instead of me reading off his notes, and then joining the conversation with Sandy. So we have with us today Nicholas Davies, writes articles, tells the very ugly truth that sounds worse than conspiracy theories, but are fact-based.
You know, Sandy, you said something about that, you know, most of the general public here at the United States are pretty aware of it. We had a group of students here a couple of weeks ago.
And we will have them back, yo.
Well, I'll probably have to bring my medication for that one. Well, you know, we're in a liberal arts school, Sandy, and of course, you know, ideas and difference of opinions, you know, flourish here like weed. But what I've noticed, you know, out in the real world is that not too many people are informed what's going on in the Middle East, which is great that you're here to pretty much, you know, spell out the truth for us. But, I really have no hope for the future as far as, foreign policy, meaning the U.S. Foreign policy, because they just really bent on making money at the expense of our soldiers. What's your take on it? I mean, you already mentioned about the industrial military, complex, but do you see any of this, you know, being reduced at all?
Let's jump there for a second before we get too depressed. I'm with that question. Let's see if there's
anything. Yeah, well, I mean, as we've been saying, I mean, the reality is that this really doesn't work, and it doesn't benefit most people here in the U.S. And, you know, while there are powerful interests driving these policies, you know, I think there's a combination of education and, you know, alternative media and activism. I mean, this is why I ended my article with links to, you know, various peace movement organizations in the U.S. that people can join and work with. And
many of them are bipartisan, just like the imperialist butchers are bipartisans. So that's also important. A lot of these anti-war movements are not linked to the parties in any direct way.
So, right. But but at the same time, you know, it is. I think everyone, you know, there are a lot of different approaches people can take. Everyone is different. Everyone has different interests and inclinations in terms of what type of activism is best for them, you know, some, you know, whether people just, you know, want to take to the street or whether people want to call or write to their member of Congress. I mean, ideally, people should be doing all of that. But ultimately, it is up to us. I mean, it is quite astonishing, really, when we look at, I mean, the people in the streets of Hong Kong today, you know, which I think is probably somewhat fomented by the, you know, outside interests, the the National Endowment for Democracy had, you know, the U.S. funded operation which helped to foment the coup in Ukraine is certainly active in Hong Kong. But the fact that it's possible to the tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of people will take to the streets so readily in many other countries, and it's quite hard to get people in the U.S. to take similar action. And yeah, I think people, you know, the U.S. is a big country, and I think people sometimes can be more easily motivated over local issues than over national issues. But, you know, when we look at what happened with the climate march just a week or two ago, you know, and I think it's very important to realize that, you know, the same interests that are structuring our economy in this militaristic way based on, you know, I mean, these are the same interests that are also structuring everything around continued use of fossil fuels. The U.S. military is the largest single user of fossil fuels in the world. And, you know, this is, we're really talking about two different models for the future of our country. Do we continue on this, with this militarized operation to exploit the resources of other countries and to dominate the world militarily, dominating the, you know, the sea lanes, the transport, all this, these fossil fuels in huge tankers where, you know, the fuel that's eventually burned and destroying our atmosphere, you know, or do we actually instead invest those resources in developing or sustainable energy? You know, I mean, a sustainable energy revolution in this country could create millions of jobs, could get us off the fossil fuels, clean up the atmosphere, and also distribute power in a completely different way, because, you know, we could actually be generating our electricity through a distributed system in which we each have solar panels on our own roofs, instead of being, you know, dependent on monopoly capitalist power distribution. You know, I have no choice right now but to get my power from Florida Power and Light, and that goes for most of us in Florida.
You know, Sandy, Shaheen said something to me the other day that kind of had an idea of it, but it kind of took me back. And it was about the oil that we buy from Saudi. He mentioned that basically the oil is very cheap, but we just happen to charge, you know, double here. And I mean, what was the comment that you made, Shaheen, at the time?
I think it was a professor that visited one of our classes, and he just started talking about the economics and the oil and how, you know, you're getting oil, free oil from the Middle East and selling it over here and making money off of the people over here. So basically, who's benefiting from that? It's not the people of this country that are benefiting. Well, of course, they're benefiting from getting the energy, but they're paying for it. Mm-hmm. So how are they benefiting from that?
Right. And Sandy, my question to you is, do you have any information on that? I mean, have you seen any data on that, whether, you know, we're basically getting hosed over here with the prices?
Well, I can tell you one of the reasons why Iraq was just such an attractive prize to the oil companies is that the actual cost of getting oil out of the ground in Iraq is something like $1 or $2 a barrel.
Less than that, even.
And, you know, it's just sitting there. And, you know, the oil companies have not got the sweetheart deals that they hoped to get to, you know, to actually have production sharing agreements where, you know, where they would actually end up getting, you know, right off the top, sort of, you know, $20, $25 a barrel. But, the what the oil companies have done ever since the main oil producers in the world nationalized their oil industries back in the 60s and 70s. You know, what they have done, as they've done in many other industries, is to divert the profit into what they call the downstream part of the market, as opposed to the upstream. So rather than most of the profits from a gallon of gas going to the people who actually take it out of the ground, more and more of the profits now go to the companies that actually bring that oil, you know, in the big tankers to the refineries, turn it into gas, and then you know, own the gas stations that distribute it to us. And of course, you know, this is the same with many, many other industries. I mean, the iPhone that I'm talking to you on now, you know, where most of the profit when I bought that iPhone went to the company that sort of developed the intellectual property and then stuck their logo on it at the end of the process, not to the companies in Taiwan and China and Japan that actually and even Germany that actually produce the actual thing that I'm holding in my hand. And so, you know, Naomi Klein explored some of this in her book, No Logo. Mm-hmm. You know, we've essentially, as the manufacturing has left the U.S. and been outsourced to these other countries around the world, they've at the same time created distribution chains in which most of the profits still accrue to that company that sticks its logo on the product, the we buy it from.
Yeah, it's a bit. And you were saying about the absolutely correct about how the profit is pushed down. I mean, that's what corporations do, and when they are allowed to do it globally with little limitations, and they can do it on a much larger scale. It should be added that the costs are go the other way around. So just like the cost of war and the hundreds of thousands dead and the millions displaced in the Middle East are part of the cost of relatively cheap oil that is not accrued, certainly not locally, to the local people other than the elites. And even no longer, to some extent, one could say that the Europeans lived it relatively, had a lot of advantages in their age of 500 years of ruling the world. That's no longer even the case for most of us here, that we benefit from the resources and labor of people in the conquered countries. But iPhone is a very good example, actually.
We all have that. Then on the attack.
We have this ongoing friendly, fight, just to add some comedy to our otherwise depressing show. And the comedy will be armies of children, mass murder, and genocide.
But here's the moral question that comes up. Since you know that tons of stuff that already happened in the process of manufacturing the phone that you just paid for cheaply, are you going to still buy that product or not?
Well, a competitive market should allow another kind of product. So it's a failure. It's a failure of our global capitalist system that's the only way we know how to produce stuff to get the rare metals that go into all our cell phones. And really, it's not fair towards Apple. Apple is just a little bit nastier than other manufacturers. They're all in it together. Apple is particularly nasty.
So in a different way, looking at it, you mean like a competitive market, like kind of Whole Foods organic stuff and then Walmart? Is that what you mean?
Well, possibly. It's difficult. In fact, I wonder at this point if that's possible. How do you stop what's going on in the Congo? And it's another place, like I was mentioning before, Sandy was talking primarily about the Middle East. And you're gonna push us through into a little bit to Ukraine that already came up, which is, I mean, we're even go, you know, and Africa, we, nobody talks about what's going on in Africa. And America is, ironically, even more than before, under an African-American president, more directly involved in more horrific things than ever before. So to ensure the access to rare resources at minimal price, we set to flame. Millions die in the most horrific genocide in the history of mankind, probably. I think Congo definitely kind of holds that record now. I mean, so how do you stop that chain? Could you, if we had a phone that was $200 more, but was clean? Or even $50 more, but did not involve the mass rape and sexual mutilation of little girls in Congo. Let's say it like it is.
Only
you know?
The elite, right. The ones that actually already
it's not on the
ripped
market.
You off,
you know, why produce
it?
That? You know, could you compete? Would you have the budget? Would you have the funding? One of the key issues are the, you know, the Mordor here, the nexus of evil is the financial. Eisenhower warned us of the things that Andy was talking about, the military industrial complex, and then left, you know, so it's a little bit like, thank you, you know, couldn't you maybe have done something about it with all your credibility and everything, but oh well. But now it's more of a financial, not so much an industrial military complex, but a financial everything complex. It all boils down to holding companies and to board of directors, who, by the way, do a lot of speculation in energy prices, which explain also part of the price that we pay more than really is necessary, let alone the fact that we're not counting the full cost of it, both in blood as well as in pollution.
Right, but then someone can come and argue and say, well, the shareholders get also some portion of that.
Well, yeah, absolutely. But again, it's a bit of a myth. You know, the shareholders are significant shareholders with votes or just with a big enough chunk of shareholding that they matter to anybody are the 1%.
So, Shaheem, you have some questions there for Sandy. I'm ready to hear these questions.
Yeah.
Go for it.
Yeah, this is Sandy. I am going to have to leave you fairly soon. So can we maybe just before I have to leave, just talk a little bit about what a better policy in terms of, because I,
that was my question, actually.
Justifications from the politicians about, about why they, they have to use military force against, these terrible threat before, these people come and attack us and,
absolutely. Let's make sure.
A little about what a better way to approach this might be.
Let's do it.
Because I think it's always, there's always a burden on us when we say, no, this is dreadful and horrible. Mm-hmm. We have to sort of come up, be able to say to people where, well, here's what we could be doing instead. Mm-hmm. And I think that's where I think it's important to go back to an analysis of what is actually what the root of the problem is. And I mean, since the U.S. invasion, the U.S. has, the U.S. and then the government it installed in Iraq have treated an entire segment of the population, the Sunni Arab population in northern and western Iraq, as a population basically, to be disenfranchised, to be marginalized, to be treated purely as a problem, to be addressed by military force, to be attacked with death squads. The U.S. In 2004 and 2005, through the Iraqi Interior Ministry, essentially set up death squads to ethnically cleanse Sunni and more secular areas of Baghdad. And, I think most of us know that, Fallujah and Ramadi both sort of rose in rebellion against the U.S. occupation and were savagely attacked by U.S. forces. And so we have this whole marginalized population of millions of people in Iraq who, and they have now essentially formed an alliance with ISIS and driven out Iraqi government forces from the areas where they live as a form of survival, you know, because rather than submitting to death squads who are simply swooping in and taking away their young men and torturing and killing them, you know, they have formed, if you like, a deal with the devil and brought in ISIS, essentially to protect them against the Iraqi government. So, I mean, clearly, and the tribal leaders in these areas have spoken publicly, you know, to the BBC and to other, whoever will talk to them, and said very clearly that, look, you know, well, one of the leader of the Anwar Tribal Council has said that in his estimation, only 5 to 7% of the fighters involved in, you know, the Sunni rebellion against the sectarian government are in fact members of ISIS, and that if the needs for political representation and, you know, economic rebuilding, you know, the basic needs of that population are met, you know, they can get rid of ISIS quite easily. You know, they do not need the U.S. to come and bomb them to get rid of ISIS. We're not going to bomb that population into getting rid of ISIS. But if we are able to reform or to restructure Iraq politically, not if we are able to, but if in conjunction with other countries and in conjunction with the powers that we have installed in the Green Zone in Iraq, we are actually able to allow, you know, a more representative, more democratic political order in Iraq that satisfies the basic political and civic needs of that population, you know, they will get rid of ISIS. So, you know, and likewise in Syria, you know, there has been a political solution on the table since 2012. Kofi Annan, had a peace proposal that came fairly close to implementation. I mean, he actually got all the different government parties and, you know, the original peaceful opposition in Syria to sign on to a document. It's called the Geneva Communique. You can Google it. And that was signed on June the 30th, 2012, over 2 years ago. And, I mean, there was even a peacekeeping force sent into Syria to monitor a ceasefire, which the government agreed to, but which a lot of these, you know, extremist rebel groups did not agree to. And so, you know, there's been a general agreement that there should be a political transition in Syria, and it is really the sticking point has always been the insistence of the U.S. and its allies that political transition has to begin with the present government of Syria essentially resigning and handing over power, rather than actually being part of a political transition.
But this is a world upside down, isn't it? I mean, it's like Alice through the Looking Glass, after all, because, you know, you have Iran and Saudi Arabia, the Gulf states in general, not very friendly, and of course disagreements between the Gulf states, but Iran are the Shia doing the killing and the murdering in Iraq for us. But Iran, our enemy, but Saudis are our good friends, and Saudis are the one that were, at least, or maybe continue, I'm not sure, arming these ISIS guys. And Turkey is our friend, but the only people really fighting ISIS until now are these communist Kurds.
Right.
So is it really, is there's nothing left but really like your most recent article. And I'll also post that, I've reposted already that awful, I mean awful in a good sense, article that you wrote back then about how it was possible to stop Syria and that really we blocked it. But is it really a completely cynical set the world on fire by people who have fat portfolios in energy and weapons for profit and the hell with the consequences? Is it little more than that?
Burn the things down and let's build them.
Well, dressed up behind sort of humanitarianism. That, I mean, essentially, you know, as I said in the article, you know, there's this famous expression which even Obama himself has used. Mm-hmm. You know, if the only tool you have is a hammer, mm-hmm. then every problem looks like a nail. And, you know, but the reality is that, I mean, if our concerns were humanitarian and if the goal of all this really was to bring peace to these regions and to actually, you know, fulfill the needs of the people in these countries, then, you know, there are political and diplomatic solutions that would do that. But, you know, the U.S., by essentially, you know, putting all our eggs in one basket, making this huge investment in, you know, in this huge hammer, this military-industrial complex, really to the exclusion of all the other things that we could be developing. I mean, you know, there's a reason why, you know, I mean, when you look at little countries like, you know, the Scandinavian countries, you know, Norway and Sweden, or some of the other European countries, you know, they put a lot more of their resources into humanitarian assistance around the world and genuine foreign aid, not military aid, but genuine foreign aid to help poorer countries and poorer societies. And you know, by and they actually produce, you know, wonderful skills diplomats, you know, really, they punch beyond their weight in diplomatic terms because that's what they invest in. They don't have the option of simply dominating other countries through massive military force and massive mm-hmm. economic power. And so, you know, they actually educate their own people. They actually, produce, you know, highly engineered products. They, you know, in Finland, if you want to be a school teacher in Finland, you have to graduate in the top 10% of your, of the, you know, of the population. You know, Germany was only recently overtaken by China as being the largest exporter of products in the world, and yet of course Germany, you know, has a quarter of the population that the United States has. So, you know, there are really different models in terms of how, you know, what we can build as a society in this country. And, you know, I'm sure, you know, you can continue that that conversation, and I know Benny's Professor Balak is well equipped to do that. But, you know, the point is, in terms of Syria and Iraq, you know, that there are diplomatic and political solutions to these problems once we stop, you know, pouring fuel on the fire and always reverting to bombing, and you know, because our government is corrupt and so dominated and corrupted by, you know, these military, industrial, and fossil fuel interests. So
That's the trick, though.
You know,
right?
I'm going to have to sign off and leave you, but
sure
I hope
thing.
I've given you all a few things to think about.
Definitely.
Absolutely.
And I will do a whole reassemblage of your recent article relevant to the topic and maybe a few more. For interested. Thanks a lot. I'm hoping, you know, I'm eager to read the next one.
Maybe assign it for one of your classes too.
Yeah.
Sandy, you rock. In my book, you're up there, buddy.
Thank you.
Thanks so much.
Thank you, Benny. and thanks to
Jesse
everyone
and
else
Shaheen.
On the call.
Absolutely.
All right. Take care, Sandy.
Bye-bye.
All right, you're listening to WPRK Winter Park, Florida, the voice of Rollins College and the best in basement radio. This is Punkonomics, of course, and we'll be right back after a couple public service announcements.
Matter of fact, it's safe to say that they would rather switch than fight.
Yeah, Punkonomics in the house. Fight the power. This is definitely I call
classic.
Social music. That's right. Anyway, back here at Punkonomics with Dr. Balak, Shaheen today dropped in and totally doing it up like before with the international scene.
As we like to say, you know, it's always we're always happy to, you know, to have people contact us if you want to, you know, say come on the show. It's always welcome, yeah?
And actually, you guys out there who are listening, you can call us here at 407-646-2915. That's right. It's not recorded or anything like that. So it's live, folks. You just give
us
a call.
No, we are recording and then putting it on a podcast.
Of course.
And
what site is that, Punkonomics?
It's all going underground in Utah. We're keeping everything just like anybody you ever called, any website you ever watched. And one day, if necessary, if you do what you're told, shut up and not fight the power, then don't worry, everything will be fine.
If you have
a problem one day, then we'll look up your file.
But if you want to know about it, check it out at punkonomics.org.
Isn't that what Obama said about privacy?
Oh, what, the classic kind of, if you haven't done anything wrong? I mean, that gets me. When I hear that, I get angry, you know, because this is really,
get angry, Benny. Go ahead.
I mean, you know, then I become like, let me all go join a militia somewhere, you know, put fatigues on and, you know, because then I'm on their side, you know, and I got some beef with some of their positions on other issues, shall we say. Those guys out in the forest, yeah?
So what do you guys think about, Sandy's article and all that? I mean,
let's summarize. I mean, first of all, it's a whole series. I mean, we kind of talked a little bit about the recent one in which he kind of gives very clear evidence to just how the military-industrial economic side of things work for this. So the sense of how you set the world on fire and make money. A small segment of the population only makes money. All you capitalist wannabe think that your 401k is getting any bigger due to this, then I got news for you, you know? Even if you're willing to overlook the murder, mayhem, and genocide being done. And I know this sounds like so, bleeding heart, whatever, but, you know, people don't even, I mean, we should consider the thousands of American soldiers, you know, dead, burnt, mutilated, and even those who physically appear to be okay, deeply scarred mentally, etc., and the veterans, and what, absolutely 100%, it's a crime against them. But I'm always a little bit shocked that in this calculus, people forget the over a million civilians, by the most conservative measures, more by some others, you know, by the most conservative, millions of civilians died in Iraq. As the direct consequence of this unnecessary, you know, and criminal invasion. Criminal both internationally as well as nationally as is imposed to the American Constitution. There's a reason why they wrote it like that back in the day. And the millions and millions dispossessed, you know, dying in the desert, right now. So the consequences of, again, to speak to, can't believe I'm doing this, right, you know, to what the Pope said, since he's cribbing our stuff, right? About how, well, the world war is going on. It's raging. Just as many people are dying as in the days of the death camps in Poland, you know?
You know, it's all brainwashing.
More.
Of course, you know, now that, you know, everybody is talking about, you know, let's go and get ISIS and all that. You see it in the media. All these movies, I mean, it's bad enough that Antenna TV keeps playing, the same old 40-year-old and even older movies. But, if you just turn on the TV, Antenna TV, not cable, okay? All you see is John Wayne.
The Duke.
That's right, riding his horse. Except, you know, he's carrying a machine gun and, you know, he's doing the World War II and all that.
That green berets or something.
But, at one point this weekend, I turned, flipped through channels and almost every single one of the Antenna TV's, channels was displaying, war movies, getting us ready. And it always happens. Every single time we're getting ready to, you know, massacre, you know, some country.
That's so interesting.
It works, doesn't it?
Yeah, no, it totally works.
Now, who's responsible about free TV?
I'm sorry?
Who's responsible about free TV?
Well, actually, the networks still own them. The major ones are NBC, ABC, CBS.
What are you saying? This free TV?
Yeah, it's free TV.
Mm-hmm. What, do you mean like antenna? That's all I got. I don't pay for cable.
Yeah, like who pays for this? You know, it needs maintenance. It needs all that stuff.
Government.
Well, PBS, you know, PBS doesn't pay that much anymore. It's been, you know, that's why you have all those sponsors and stuff. So PBS is, and there, I mean, that's a whole can of worms to open here, you know, in terms of propaganda, how even a free press eventually does what it's told under certain conditions, you know.
Right. Well, you know, that's just said. I mean, when I see that, and then of course we have, guests, you know, students, you know, from here, they're going like, well, yeah, we're the, you know, USA, we're the only ones that can go and do this around the world, you know, and I'm going like, well, okay, well, obviously you guys are not going to be shooting anything.
That's
you know,
fair.
You're just going to be sitting at home watching it on TV if the, you know, stations
will
play that.
Well, it's fair and not fair, let's say, because you could still have an opinion about what to do, right? I mean,
sure.
One of the things is like, if indeed, you know, the Neo, and we'll open that up again, when we have him back.
Mm-hmm.
You know, absolutely, and we are, because it was cool, and it's our only hope, I think, is having this dialogue. So let's put away the propaganda, the whole humanitarian, the whole, like, you know, weapons of mass destruction, the whole they're coming to get us, imminent threat. All that is 100% unadulterated bovine feces.
Right.
Say that. Right?
There you go.
Let's just say it. This is just sorry about that, yeah? If we at least need to talk about the neo-imperialist paradigm, like in foreign affairs, you guys might know him, you know, Neil Ferguson, this British guy who's basically following Kipling, who was one of those kind of liberal in the sense of nice guys. You know, everybody knows him from Jungle Book. He wrote some other things and wrote a famous poem, White Man's Burden, right? About how America, now that Britain is becoming weaker, it cannot hold to its empire. This is before World War even. They already saw it coming. They wouldn't have lasted much longer anyway. They were also devolving something that should be familiar to Americans, tragically, into, you know, massacring civilians, yet still losing conflicts, sending their superior military, yet still more cost than benefit.
Right.
Before world wars really put an end to it. So, you know, you see, the Germans did something good.
well,
I can say that, right? I'm Jewish from European origins.
What bothers me the most is that, you know, and I'm 100% behind the troops, I mean, and, you know, the guys that go out there and take the shot. And all that. But when you look up at the people that go there, okay, are usually the poor, you know, whites and minorities, so disenfranchised. Because the well-to-do will not go unless they have officers.
I mean, they are exceptions. You know, they are exceptions.
Sure,
but in the numbers,
sure,
you're absolutely right. Are there rich families that have a military tradition and their kids go? Of course, they go to be officers, and a good officer gets shot at too. So, I mean, I'm not saying that in any sense.
But there are very few of them, though.
Their numbers in the army is small. That's absolutely true. And there's a good, that's why there's never going to be a draft. If there was, maybe there should be, quite frankly. I might ship my kids out of the country. But it might be good if, at the very least, that would be one thing to change the incentive so that people will be a little bit hesitant on going into these kind of adventures.
Right, and with that hesitation, they probably would go and vote and try to change things so they won't have to go through
if you're wealthy, you don't do it anyway unless you want to. Unless you're like a patriot or you're whatever, for whatever reasons, you decide you want to. I mean, not even when they had a draft, people avoided it too if they wanted
to. Well, you know, I come from that era from the draft, and when it was coming up for my number, you better believe I was thinking about going to vault as well as going to Canada. But, you know, that's just it. I mean, when you're at the risk, when you see that you have no other choice and more than likely you're going to get your head blown off, then you become more proactive politically, you know, with your government. So you're right. Maybe
it's
we need
never
to
gonna
have the
draft. Yeah, but that's never going to happen. And that we will have to deal with a little bit in the sense of working with solutions. If Americans all got together and not just Americans, let's talk about America now, you know, got together and we sat together with our different ideologies and argued about it, as we are going to argue with my good student friends next week again, you know, and just is giving them hell. They're good kids, they're strong kids, they can take some hell, it's good for them. As the American saying goes, that doesn't kill you, makes you stronger.
I'm
right?
The one that might need some medication and alcohol after that.
So you'll take
that.
Something, you know, you'll take something and we'll sedate Jesse and he'll be all right. But let's openly look at what Neil Ferguson, The White Man's Burden. Is America really necessary? Now, whatever the background is, no matter what happened, right now a superpower, it's not working out very well to anybody with who's not on meds and or I don't know what exactly, even meds, I don't know, can really make you hallucinate this strongly to think that this is actually working out in some sense for America or for the vast majority of Americans. And how many of, you know, Corey, who's going to be back in town soon, used to say, like, you know, what's the end game? Even if you are of the 1% or 0.01%, mm-hmm. you know, are you really, so what's you're going to leave this place? Is that really what
survival, man. It's just survival.
Go on some floating island somewhere in the ocean and abandon America to the hordes of zombies? Mm-hmm. I mean, is that their plan? I don't think so. I really think, honestly, they have patriotism. They're mistaken. I think it's a mistake.
Even if you wanted to, you couldn't go to Tuvalu, which is actually pretty much being submerged right now because of the rise of the waters, you know, due to climate change.
Yeah. Well, the global elite have enough money to build a second story.
Probably.
Frankly, you know, I mean, again, the concentration of wealth is such that we could do a lot of things, you know, but the bottom problem is how to solve them. Even if we are of the opinion that, no, we need an American empire to create like Rome, you know, a Pax Americana around the world. Perhaps a little, and then we could have arguments like what Sandy was mentioning at the end. The American political scientist Joseph Nye Jr., who invented the term soft power, the notion precisely that you take instead of like bombing them, you know, you build a school, you even in a rather cynical way, you don't care about their education, you don't care about their sanitation, but just in order. So that America becomes something else around the world than death from the sky. Because, again, put the ethics aside, it's not working. So that this kind of argument, I think, isn't happening in most, certainly not in the mainstream media. And sadly, the statistics are conflicting. You know, somebody like, and I'd be happy to make a plug here, I'm a big fan, Dan Carlin, he has two shows, one on Hardcore History, which is a history thing, which is wonderful, podcasts. Go search for him on iTunes or whatever, or online. Or he does, Common Sense, which is kind of a little bit like us, you know, though it's more of a monologue and more structured and, you know. He has a big audience. And, tens of thousands of people listening, downloading his podcast, on a regular basis, you know? And that's big, actually, because, you know, CNN, I think I mentioned that before, CNN counts every single screen in a toilet in a bus terminal as if it's in full capacity and everybody's watching. And that's in their numbers. So actually, you know, all these Wolf Blitzer types and stuff have a lower, much lower audience than Dan Carlin that nobody heard of. Except for the tens of thousands of people who download this podcast on a regular basis. Democracy Now! Has a pretty impressive audience. So there's some hope that way, I suppose. But who cares what the people think, right?
But, you know, those stations are very few compared to the other stations, the, you know, propaganda stations, you know, for no other words to call them. I mean, last night I was actually looking through TuneIn Radio to see, you know, what's out there talk show wise. Yeah. And I was totally appalled at the fact that there is very few stations that actually, yeah, I'm not saying that it should be all left wing or liberal or whatever it is that you know, I am. But what, you know, just right cut down in the middle, there isn't, you know, not enough of them.
Not at all.
And again, when you talk about empire, And my strong belief, I mean, look at me, I'm like waving the black flag here now. I put down the red flag completely in a sense, right?
ISIS,
I mean,
I'm like, flag? I'm just kidding.
No. No, but the right wing, you know, anarchist or, you know, the libertarian, whatever. I'm like, that's one of the things. I disagree with Ron Paul on monetary policy completely. I think he's just doesn't make any sense, let alone, yeah. But when it comes to this, and look at the kind of flack he gets, from his own party, or did,
sure,
until recently, and even his son, that was kind of initially, like, I mentioned him today, because I, you know, when people do good things, it's important to, at least when they bulk the, what's scary to me is the consensus, you know? So now all the, you said, like you, liberals and stuff, so what, are you gonna vote for Hillary?
Well,
Hillary will make Barack Obama, you know, look like a peace, like a deserving of a Nobel Peace Prize.
Mm-hmm.
Oops.
True. But then again, at opposed to not voting,
my pun not hit.
Well, hold on.
At opposed to not voting, where then the other guys, you know, who are
whatever,
completely extremely
Cruz,
right, will win, you know, with ease.
Well, how we're being played.
Exactly.
That's how the
you're
game
right.
Is
you're
done.
Right about that.
Now, speaking of Hillary,
okay.
I need to mention something. Have you guys checked her book out yet?
Mm. No.
Okay, good for you.
Oh, please. No. I mean, of course, this is also, we could give her, cut her some slack in the sense that she's a mainstream politician. Therefore, she has to be really, really nauseating. It's kind of part of the job. But even Elizabeth Warren,
Elizabeth Warren.
Yeah, but when it came to foreign policy, most explicitly when it came to, you know, Israeli policy and the region, she was completely not even a mild peeps. I'm sure that if she was sitting here with us today, when all the microphone was off, she would say, because I think also that she's probably a decent person, would say, well, no, I just had to, because my focus is economics. And
right,
she would
right.
have a very good argument. Okay, I'm sorry, you know, this is not liable. I'm sorry if I'm channeling a little bit word here. I'm pretending. I'm role-playing video games here.
Mm-hmm.
If she is as good as I'd like to think she is, she'd probably be saying, listen, I had to do it. I think perhaps in some sense, if we are to one day stop this madness, a significant part is reconstructing some kind of at least semblance of democratic rule in America, so that the opinions of the majority of Americans and their interests are heard, as they mm-hmm. have been to some extent in the post-war era for a while, for a few decades, kind of between the beginning of the 20th century
right.
to the two-thirds of it, they were heard.
It's a chess game for them, because at any point if she came out mm-hmm. and even said anything remotely like what we say on this program,
mm.
she will
she's
be
finished.
She's finished.
Instant. Yeah.
So, you know, and it's unfortunate that we live in a society
and
like
Rand
that.
And Rand Paul, same thing, to go to the other side. She's like a progressive liberal, right? And he's like a libertarian, hardcore, whatever. But he's not a Tea Partier, because in the sense, and again, my love goes out to any kind of authentic, angry right-winger, angry at centralized government. I'm with you, brother. But, or should I say comrade, or sister, but they have been well co-opted.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the Occupy movement was not really co-opted. They were just beaten and dispersed in a sense, because they wouldn't co-opt. If they would have become a nice progressive liberals, then as the Democratic Party tried to seduce them, but they wouldn't dance.
What right. happened to, the people in St. Louis?
Going on.
Still?
Just now, yeah, just they're still fighting it. I mean, it's no longer the news, so it's a little harder for them. But yeah, they're still getting into trying to raise hell about the fact that this all nothing happened.
Just kind of the media's taking it down.
Yeah,
and
we're
instead
bored
bringing
now,
up
you know.
Some
we have to wait
things.
For another black kid to be gunned down like a dog in the street, and
like
then
here
for a few
in
days,
Florida, a couple of years ago in Sanford.
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, you don't have to go too far. I mean, a couple of weeks ago in downtown Orlando. Some women got shot,
right.
you know, by mistake,
mm-hmm.
because the police didn't know how to handle this one, you know, suspect that they were dealing with. You know, shot goes out and boom, here's an innocent person dead.
Or the guy ever between that I can't think of his name right now. As you know, I'm often with names. But was like a black guy in Walmart checking out a BB gun.
Oh yes.
Yes.
Oh my God. I saw the video.
Yeah.
I saw the video. Yeah, I
can't
could
even
not believe
that.
I showed it to you. It's where he's getting shot. several times. Yeah. It may have been my roommate that I showed it to.
Somebody called 911 and said there's a black man waving a gun around. And the police just came in, you know. Good thing they didn't shoot his family, too. Just shot him in front of them. You know, after Trayvon Martin, I do remember his name, I guess, in Sanford, there was... published kind of research that the grassroots movement, Malcolm X grassroots movement, I think. Again, me and my names, I'm so sorry. Anybody who wants a reference, you know, like I tell my students, I tell it to the whole Central Florida community and beyond, you know, just fire me an email or a message or something. Ask for the reference. I'll look it up for you and give it to you. I will, please. But basically every 26 hours, a black person is gunned down on in America. So, you know, if some of them are so obscene cases, or maybe because people raise hell about it, that we hear about it.
Right.
It's horrifically common.
Yeah. And I have to bring a point too that, a friend of mine actually mentioned this to me. He says, well, you know, he realizes that, most of the people that are getting shot nowadays by the numbers, of course, statistics are, you know, black people and minorities, but, you know, also white people get shot. But the ones that do get shot are also, you know, completely poor, you know.
Absolutely.
So I mean, when you look at the white collar crimes, you know, there isn't any of that going on. And I mean, it's just so disproportionate.
The difference with the black people, that even if you're rich, it doesn't help you.
Right.
You know, you're
exactly.
still going to be gunned down. The country, if you ride around in a nice car, you know, they'll probably stop you for that. I mean, understand, please, audience, you know, I mean, we're all like, we're laughing because it's, otherwise we would
I saw something really funny, where this black couple, lived in a really nice neighborhood, and I guess, they heard some prowess in the back, and, wife says to the husband, call the police, call the police. And the husband says, are you kidding? And we call the police. Well, don't shoot us.
Exactly.
But it's so true. Yeah, it's so true.
True.
You know, it's just totally unbelievable. But anyway, we have a song that we're going to play.
Oh yeah. Which one are we playing?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Dumb. Wait a second. Check it out. So I wanted to say, because, Jesse was playing, Public Enemy. From the '80s, right? Dating himself and all. Those are the good. I mean, I have an argument with my kids about 80 music. My daughter like changes channel. I say, what the hell? Yeah, that's the best music.
Actually, my father turned me onto it. I'm just kidding.
but anyway. Chuck got me into it.
Hip hop, right? Hip hop, socially conscious hip hop, political hip hop, not the, what it turned the monster that was recreated out of it, you know, later on, the rap, you know, the sexist, you know, money grabbing. I mean, in fact, that is one of the most effective and most virulent forms of racist anti-black propaganda in America, is that image of the this kind of stuff that the commercial rap music where the black man is sexist, cares only about money. You know, it's really a horrific kind of minstrel show caricature. It's terrible, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And wait a minute, I'm not talking about the style of it. It's not that you have to be all like soul and sweet. No. I love personally hardcore gangster rap. I listen to Immortal Technique. I listen to back in the day. In those days, I mean, they weren't even bad enough for me. I was more like, you know, other bands, you know, go by the acronyms, you know, NWA and things like that, you know, and Dr. Dre and things very inappropriate, calling for, you know.
Right.
So it's not about that. It's about the fact that this commercial music has turned into a rather nasty creature.
We have no social contact at all.
But hip-hop, coming from the streets of America in the late 70s and such, has caught fire all over the world. So today it is the music of political protest. In the 60s were, you know, all these Woody Guthrie, right?
Right.
That inspired the hippies and stuff, folk music, what have you. There were, you know, different countries also, that was less of a global world. So, you know, in South Africa, there was Miriam Makeba, you know, so it was kind of, you know, great music, African-based, modernized, jazzized, what have you. But today, it's really in the global world. Hip-hop is the music of the underdog, is the music of revolt. And it goes from American streets to in Latin America, and in the Middle East too. Yeah, I guess metal too deserves some credit there. I'm not as knowledgeable or into metal music, though I appreciate it.
It has a little bit of the social content in it. It used to have a lot more at the beginning.
Yeah.
But not anymore.
So I think there's some, I mean, it's often drowned in the commercial, right, tsunami that it's hard to see. So I know a lot of people don't even know about independent, socially conscious hip hop. They never heard it before. So they look, you say hip hop, they think of some kind of dude in a white suit with naked chicks twerking around him.
You mean like Pop Daddy?
Yeah. And while he lights cigars with $100 bills and stuff, you know? But that's not what it's supposed to be. So anyway, yeah, so I brought a couple of things that I found. This is in Arabic, so that way I don't have to worry about clean lyrics, right? I assume. But it's a Palestinian group. It's actually, interestingly enough, not in the occupied territories. It's from Lod, which gives them a bit of an advantage, at least, to be able to travel abroad and get like Algerian rappers living in France to help them produce their first album a few years back. So they're actually from the Israeli, not occupied, but actually annexed territories.
Cool. And we're going to have Shaheen interpret this for us.
Yeah, I'll try.
You'll try?
Yeah. Well, the title is who's a terrorist? Question mark.
All right, here we go. So. مين إرهابي أنا إرهابي كيف إرهابي وأنا عايش ببلادي مين إرهابي أنت إرهابي مكلني وأنا عايش ببلادي قتلني زي ما تلت إجدادي أجل الخنون عن صادي ما انت يا عدو بتلعب دور الشاهد المحامي والقاضي علي قاضي نهايتي بادي حلمك نقل فوق معنى آلية حلمك لآلية تصير بالمقابر أكترية ديمقراطية والله انكم ناسية من كثر ما اغتصبت النفس العربية حبلت ولدت ولد اسمه عملية انفجارية وهنا ديتنا ارهابية يعني ضربتني وبكيت سبعتني واشتكيت لما ذكرتك انك بدين نصيت وحكيت ما انتو بتخلوا ولاد صغار يرموا حجار ما لهمش اهل يدبوهم بالدار ايش كنو نسيت انو استحق ضب الاهل تحت الحجار وعلى لما وجع الفار بتناديني ارهابي مين ارهابي انا ارهابي كيف ارهابي وانا عايش في بلادي مين ارهابي انت ارهابي ماكلني وانا عايش في بلادي ليش ارهابي عشان دمي مش هادي حامي عشان رافع راسي وارض بلادي قتلوا حبايبي انا لحالي اهلي تشردوا راح اضلي انادي انا مش ضد السلام السلام ضدي علي بده يهدي تراثي بده يمحي واللي بيحكي كلمة بشد ورا همة بيكون زلمة تعملوا منه رمة ومين انتو لسه امتى خبرتو اتصلوا عداش قتلتو عداش قتمتو امياتنا بيبكوا ابياتنا بيشكوا اراضينا بيخطفوا انا بقولكم مين انتو انتو خبرتو بزلا احنا كبرنا فقر من كبر فوسع ومن كبر جحر صار في داعي عملتو منه اجرامي وانت يا ارهابي بتناديني ارهابي مين ارهابي انا ارهابي كيف ارهابي وانا عايش ببلادي مين ارهابي انت ارهابي ماكلني وانا عايش ببلادي امتى ببطل ارهابي لما تضربني كف واعطيك خد تاني كيف تتوقع مني اشكر الاذاني تعرف ايش انت قولي كيف دخياني راكع ركبي وايدي مربطات عيون بالارض وجثث مزتتات بيوت مهدومه عائلات مشردات اطفال يتيمه حريه بكلبشات انت عمر انت قطر احنا بنقبر ما علينا بنصبر وجعنا بنسطر اهم شيء انك تحس بامان اتريح وسيب لنا الالام ما هو دمنا دم كلاب حتى لا لما الكلب يموت في الرفق بالحيوان يعني دمنا ارخص من دم الكلاب لا دمي غالي راح ادافع حالي لو تناديني ارهابي مين 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 ارهابي انت ارهابي All right, welcome back to Punkonomics. Shaheen just kind of gave us a quick synopsis of what went on the air.
Google can give you the whole thing, really.
Really?
They're reasonably successful in Europe, again, because of the help and the support to some extent of some French Algerian rappers.
Because it's really good quality, too.
Yeah, so that's produced and stuff. Yeah. There's some, I have a little collection of some more, literally even Gazan hip hop and stuff. So there have, nice. But it's also interesting. Just people don't imagine, you know, to think like, can you imagine a female Gazan hip hop artist? Nice. Well, yeah, you know, nice. Yeah. I don't know, she's probably dead, you know? I mean, you know, like I said, because you know what's going on there. I mean, I don't know if people realize what happened over there. I mean, you can tell stories, you can even believe them about missiles and tunnels and, But the result has been mass destruction and the death of thousands of civilians again. Mm-hmm. It'll take them, if they got access to all the possible international aid in the world, unlimited credit, it'll take them 10 years to build it up, you know? So now the horror starts. Now the no medicine, no water, no clean water, no electricity, you know, living in a pile of rubble in the desert. So the babies die, you know? I mean, even there's a lot of consequences when the bombs are no longer falling, yeah?
But then when they build all of that again, another war comes in, takes the whole thing down.
So what were the main lyrics on this song?
If I can recall, it was, I'm not a terrorist, you're the terrorist, you're in my country, and you're calling me a terrorist. What also, I barely remember. But it's
something about I'm not against peace. Peace is against me.
Yeah. That was one of the lines too.
I love that line.
It's a good line.
Yeah, most of it was interesting. I got to run for my class though. I have history of jazz, so I'm going to be listening to some jazz.
Say hi to Chuck for me.
I will.
Sweet class right there.
Yeah, just relax and sit in there.
Relax.
Only if you
no wish. Hard bop.
Nope.
No.
Relaxing jazz. I like unrelaxing. I really don't like relaxing music. I'm not much of a relaxing.
Chuck Archer, one of our professors here, is the Benny Ballack of music.
All right.
Yeah, he's awesome, man.
You should
stop in his class sometime.
And he won as the best professor 2 years ago. Or last year?
2013. Yeah, the year I graduated here.
Yeah, the best professor at Rollins. Yeah, which is interesting. And I'm thinking actually of creating a new chapter here at Rollins to give, prizes for the best professor, for the most terrible professor, you know, for the hardest professor. And yeah, so we'll see. Maybe we'll plan that and get it running by the spring, hopefully.
It could be a weird kind of a leaderboard kind of competition, right?
Yeah, that'd be great.
That, you achieve the most hated professor?
And you should give
a nice guy.
You should give prizes for alumni that won't leave campus like myself.
Well, it's like in The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Universe, right? The infinitely prolonged.
Yep.
Well, thank you guys for having me in here, and
it's
I
a
will
pleasure.
See
As
you
always.
Next week, hopefully.